part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
Fanboy.com.
I can hear you.
Oh,
can you hear me?
Evan didn't have his speakers on. Hold on.
Okay.
Wait a minute. That's not hilarious or anything. I just turned them off when I was not listening to the station.
Hey,
looks good.
Okay, so you're all set up?
Oh, okay.
You guys can hear each other fine?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Yay.
You don't have to pat me on the back like I'm six. I mean, at least give me a thumbs up like I'm 10. Okie dokie. Thanks, Sarah. I'll call you if something goes stupid.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
No problem at all.
No, thank you. And, I guess we should just get started.
I don't know what the hell.
Skype and all that stuff can be confusing, so I'm just glad
I only use it for interviews. My daughter's used it to talk to people, you know, and so I don't set it up that often. If I use something on the computer enough times, I've reached some kind of some tipping point. I can remember how to do it. Like, I can scan things the last 2 years.
Yeah, well, you're a comic artist, so
I don't have to call my wife 5 times, you know, 20 times a day. It went down to 5, then 3.
Yeah.
Now it's Skype, you know? So, yeah, I haven't done an interview in months on Skype. I don't do that many interviews, so.
Yeah, well.
It's shocking, right? I'm in such demand, it appears, right?
Well, you are to me anyway.
Well, thanks. You can interview me every other day then.
It would be my pleasure. Trust me.
Oh, you get real sick of me, really.
I don't think so. I've got so much to pick your brain about that.
My brain isn't that large, so don't pick it too.
Well, let me just start off by saying, like, I'm Christian Horn, and this is Part-Time Fanboy, and I have on the line, someone who is, you're like a legend to me, honestly. Like,
You need more friends, and you need to get out more often, please.
I get out plenty, trust me. I have Evan Dorsey.
Avoiding the police is different.
Yeah, that's true. I have Evan Dorkin on the line, who is, amongst many things, the creator of Milk and Cheese, the co-creator of, like, Beasts of Burden, correct?
Right.
An animation writer.
I guess.
And most
recently, I don't think of myself as an animation writer. It's like, I'm not. That's not false humility. It's just It doesn't, like, I have to remind myself that we've done that. it's not like even a joke. It's like, if somebody asks, what do you do? I don't mention that. It does not come to mind. It's comics is what comes to mind.
Oh, God. Well, that's really cool. But you are you were currently working on a script recently, last time I contacted you, right?
Sarah and I just got our Ben 10 episode approved by the Cartoon Network.
Well,
so
congratulations.
Because we can get our check now.
Well, you know, either way, you've got the Eltingville Club, you know, Dork. You've just got, like, this great history of, like, humorous comics that I've enjoyed since I was, you know, younger. And honestly, like, Milk and Cheese and that stuff just came across at a point in time for me that just, like, renewed my faith in comic books when I found them, because...
Well, how were you in college or high school?
Yeah, I was in college. I was probably, like...
Excuse me, I dropped my pen. The younger people are, the better Milk and Cheese, I think, reads for them.
It still holds up for me. I mean, I still love it. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, but you called me a legend, so your tastes are suspect.
Well, I think I have very good taste, but all right.
Okay. I'm fond of them, but I just, you know, most people who like... People don't seem to get into them after the age of, like, I don't know, 25, maybe? I don't know.
Really? Because I gave them to some of my friends for Christmas when the hardcover came out.
Right.
And they loved them. They were just like...
Well, you know, you're probably going to AA meetings or something.
Wow.
They need some entertainment, so...
No,
that's great. I don't have a great sense of my audience on that book anymore. When it came out in comics form and you got snail mail...
Yeah.
it was almost always from younger people. I mean, I was younger then. It always seemed to come from college. Yeah. Colleges or, college radio stations or punk bands or something like that. So these days, people don't really write you mail.
That's true.
Fan mail is all online now. Somebody either likes something you did or doesn't like something you did. They're posting it on Twitter or Instagram so you don't see most of.
Oh, I gotcha.
And if you go by Amazon reviews, people usually complain about the way Amazon packaged it and
That's true.
Well, that's good. I mean, we're selling the books to somebody because we're in a third printing, and I would have assumed everybody who liked Milk and Cheese from the first 15, 20 years, they were done with it. So somebody's buying it.
Well, I'm one of them, so, you know. And I also bought the recent, you signed it for me at New York Comic Con, the Eltingville Club, you know, the two issues, which I read on the plane back to L.A. and literally made me laugh out loud on the plane. Like, I could not hold it in. So, you know, if this is like Evan Dorkin, this is your life right now. You're doing a good job.
Okay, I got you. I see what you said. I'm glad that they made you laugh. I just ran across somebody talking about how depressing it was.
No, not at all.
I don't think it's depressing either, but I guess you know, because it's not about anyone specifically. It's about a certain kind of person.
Yeah, well, I think at least with the Eltingville Club, these are the last two issues, right? Like,
I'm done.
You're done with it.
I'm very happily ex-Eltingville.
Really? I'll ask you about that later. But sure. The thing that I have to say is that, and going back and looking at my dork comics and the chapters that I had before, like, you were really concise and really good about picking up a lot of the things that, like, sort of in nerd culture are sort of crazy, but just kind of accepted, like, as a norm. And the way that people behave or the things that they, you know, latch onto, that they grasp on, like I don't know, are you like taking notes at conventions? Like, how do you?
Well, I'm a fan.
Yeah.
And I pay attention.
Uh huh.
And I worked. You know, I grew up pre-internet.
Yeah.
I don't have a good memory for people or addresses or phone numbers or events or history or geography. I have a good memory for supervillain identities.
Yeah, me too.
Who animated on Fleischer Brothers Popeye cartoons, things like, you know, what the names of the alternate names of Toho monsters, really useless crap.
Yeah.
And so I remember things related to that. And I worked in a comic store for a year, off and on for 6 years. I worked in a store, got fired from a store, managed a store, left the store, came back to the store, that sort of stuff. And I've gone to conventions since I'm about 12 years old.
Gotcha.
So I don't have to write a lot of this stuff down. Plus, it's playing out on the internet. So all you'd have to do is Google, fandom jackass asshole. You know, it used to be a lot harder. I used to have to ask people for horror stories. But also, these two issues, these last two, I picked up. Probably the only one that I made extensive notes on except for the trivia contest one, because it was about retailing, the first issue, and I did pick up stories knowing that I was going to work on it about retail shops, or made notes, and because some of the stupidity in the first issue of this last arc is based on real stuff or is directly taken from real retail behavior.
Yeah.
Sad to say.
Yeah. Well, what nailed me most, and, you know, I mean, my site is called Part-Time Fanboy, and it's mostly because, you know, as you get older, you sort of, it's not that you have to leave, like, sort of the fandom a little bit, but there's other things to put your money into, and comics get a little more expensive, and you have to sort of make the painful choice, like, am I going to keep reading Superman, or do I cut this off so that I can read something else, or...
Well, you mentioned you have a family, right?
Yeah.
Well, but you're not thinking of them now, because you're selfish. You're selfish.
Yeah.
I'm in the same situation. You know, I was just saying something online about, I have the comics collection, you know, books with a spine. I have the comics collection of a rich collector. I have, but the income of a quite the opposite. You know, you get a lot of free books, and you know, I have a great relationship with my local store. But if I did not have that, we use the library a lot for reading a lot of new comics in collection form, especially manga, because where do you put that stuff?
That's true.
You know, I mean, if you follow a series that's into, you know, 23 volumes, I mean, anybody who's collecting One Piece right now has a whole, like, One Piece bedroom, probably.
Yeah.
But I don't know who has the money for this stuff.
Yeah.
Especially have a family.
Somebody does, because you go to the comic shops and, you know, people, I guess, thankfully, are still buying, of course, right?
Yeah, there's those 17 guys at a shop who still buy the stack.
Yeah.
When I was working in a store, it was the late 80s. And, you know, we were all in awe of the person who could buy the stack. Although, a lot, you know, when they were 75 cents...
it wasn't that big a deal.
One customer who was a dentist, and he, you know, he had a family, but he made good money, and at 75 cents, he literally hit a brick every week.
Yeah, well, when do you read them?
You didn't have the number of collections you have now. It's amazing that, you know, luckily every store has, you know, a dozen or two dozen people who who can't stop.
Yeah.
And, I hope they enjoy it, but from going into the store and from remembering when I was a retailer, who buy the stack seem to hate 2/3 of it at least. Complain, you know. I had a roommate who bought books. He bought comics. He couldn't stand it. I said, "Why do you buy this? Why are you buying Suicide Squad?" And he goes, "I have all the others."
Yeah. Well,
I'm like, okay. Do you keep your toothpaste tubes? I mean
well, the thing that you really and you hit the nail on the head, because for me the thing that you really nailed is the obsessiveness of the culture and the fear of sort of falling out of it, which I
understand that to a degree. I mean, you know, I did a strip about Gotta Have My Batman about, you know, these two guys, and over time, and they keep hearing announcements that retailers have to, whoever buys Batman gets kicked in the balls, or Batman's going to be done by people that they don't care for, but they still got to have their Batman's coming packed with anthrax, but they got to have their Batman. I understand the obsessive. I mean, I have OCD issues, and it's, you know, I'm 50 years old and I'm still dealing with these things. It helps to fuel the fan-oriented, the pop culture-oriented material I do. It definitely does, because a lot of it's about myself, you know?
Yeah.
But a lot of it is observed, and I mean, there's people who hoard, and there are people who cannot, who, it, you know, it's like they must be invited to every party, even if they don't like the people at it.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of an addiction, right?
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, it's compulsive behavior. It's obsessive behavior.
Yeah.
I mean, don't know why you must. If you're not enjoying something, there's no reason to pay attention to it. I mean, I'm a wrestling fan, but I haven't watched wrestling except for some Lucha Libre. I haven't watched kind of since Chris Benoit.
Uh-huh.
Murdered his family, and Eddie Guerrero died, and it was just, I wasn't enjoying the shows that much, and there was no competition really for WWE, and it's just, I like wrestling, I don't like talking in the ring.
Gotcha. And
so I stopped. Oh. You know, but it took a while. I was not enjoying WCW and WWE towards the ends of the runs of WCW's run. And I just stopped, and I wasn't watching Lucha Libre because we got rid of cable. But now I just don't have time. But I still, if the times that I find myself, somebody tells me, oh, by the way, so-and-so is back in this Fed, or the 80th anniversary of CMLL, I mean, I'll just start reading about it. And the next thing I know, that's 2 hours shot.
Yeah.
I get it. I mean, it's easy for me to avoid superhero movies and stuff because I'm just not too interested anymore.
Yeah.
But if you put something I was interested in front of me, I'll start reading every Lovecraft thing that you slap down, or watching Hong Kong flicks in a row if I could, or monster, you know, horror movies. I could play pinball until my arms break, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody's got their thing.
Sure.
But if you're not having fun, something's wrong. And if you're spending money on something that's not fun, at some point you just have to, you know what I mean? Cut bait loose. I mean, you know, cut bait.
Yeah.
It's tough. Can always come back.
That's true.
And it's all digital. Everything's on digital now. It's not going away. You don't have to have that one. I don't understand why anybody even collects variant covers. They're all online.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If you like the angle, but they look beautiful. And I agree. Most variant covers are really, really nice because they hire people who do really nice artwork.
Yeah.
They don't hire people like me for them. They hire artists.
Oh, shut up. I have to tell – the first time I've ever had to tell a guest to shut up. I'm sorry. That was very rude of me. Your artwork is great. They should be hiring you to do alternate covers.
I'm not a cover artist. I'm not a very good one image maker, in my opinion. I'm a lot – I'm more limited to what my art does well and what it doesn't do and what my limitations are. But I'm not a great, you know, I'm not the person you want for a Batman cover in general in this industry. I don't do them anyway, but that's a whole other issue. but the thing is, most of these covers are beautiful. I have friends who do these covers, but I don't understand the need to have multiple covers in your house of the same comic book.
No, I don't get that either.
And when I get into debates or arguments with people about variant covers as a drag on the industry, by and large, from a retailing point of view, from a, you know, as a gimmick, they say, well, they look great. And I'm like, yeah, they called pinups. They used to put them inside the book.
Yeah.
And they do look great, but 40 of them?
Yeah.
Make a poster book, which they probably will do anyway. But, you know, they're soaking the same fans over and over, and people say, well, nobody's forcing them to buy it. And I'm like, yeah, that's true, but it's still going to, you know, it's still digging a tunnel underneath our feet.
Yeah.
It happens every time a gimmick blows up.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's black and white books or it's arrows type books or it's glitter on the covers or it's holograms or it's pogs or whatever retailers feel forced to buy.
Yeah.
Whether they're into them or not. I mean, it's hard to order this stuff because it's always a guessing game. And then you have to guess and make goals to get 5 copies of something that everyone except collectors and speculators is going to forget about.
Yeah. So do you – I know there's been some talk like online lately of like another bubble or something like hitting comics. Do you think that sort of thing might be coming?
I have no – I'll tell you, I'm not paying attention.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
I'm not paying attention to general retail trends these days.
Yeah.
I've got enough, you know, the news is depressing enough, comic book news.
Okay.
I don't need that on top of that. But I find when I am paying attention to it, I am in a worse mood.
Okay.
But, it's business. Business always goes in hills and valleys. Comics is a really emotional business.
Yeah.
A lot of the choices made and the things offered are in the spirit of fandom.
Yeah.
And that brings in obsessiveness and compulsiveness and plays on that. I mean, when there's more than one Star Wars can opener or bottle opener on the market, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a lot of stuff nobody needs, but people start. You get 3 of them and you have a collection and then you can't stop. So you get more glasses and you get more comics. And it's generally the same people who buy comics products over and over.
Yeah.
Except for those times where Marvel or DC or Archie calls their friend at the New York Post or USA Today or the Daily News, or and they get a big, you know, Robin's losing his virginity or Aunt May's getting health care issues, and they make a big deal out of it. Or, you know, Archie meets Kiss or Archie meets the Chipmunks or whatever the goddamn, or Justin Bieber. And then people will come into a store going, do you have that Batman comic that was on the news?
Yeah.
But those things stay in people's houses. They buy 2 of them and then they come to your store and want to sell them a year later.
Gotcha.
And then you show them the box you still have of extras that you gambled on.
Well, let me ask you this.
I'm sure, anyway, I'm sure there's going to be something at some point, but I don't know what the new talk is. But after a while, the gimmick burns itself out.
Sure.
There's only so many variant covers. How many aren't they putting out, like 100 of them with the new Dark Knight?
Yeah, I think it was like 40 last I heard.
Why do they need the crutch on something like Dark Knight?
Yeah.
It's always going for the short term. Comics always goes for the short term.
Yeah.
Even though obviously comics should realize at this point that we're in it for the long term.
Yeah.
Especially the companies that are owned by Disney and Warner Brothers, who are using them as a petri dish for TV shows and movies, it's a long-term thing. The publishing does not have to tap that vein constantly and burn out the same. It just needs to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Make sure it doesn't drop dead completely. But putting out the gimmicks is such, it's exhausting. It's a treadmill that the publishers get themselves on. They could be putting that time and that effort and that thought into the actual core books and maybe prop up their mid-list.
Yeah.
Which that involves thought and work. And, you know, people are lazy. I'm lazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Who wants to worry about how to try to get Aquaman selling again?
Yeah, that's true.
Or, you know, whatever. I don't know, Nova. What are they even publishing?
Well,
they're publishing the same stuff they published when I was a kid.
Yeah, well, that's true. And it's
all the same stuff.
Yeah, it's sort of been the cycle. Like, so that would kind of bring me to sort of one of my big questions, which is like, how did the obsession get started with you? When did you start reading comics? Do you remember what the first comic was that you ever read?
No, I don't.
You don't? Oh, wow.
No, I don't. I was very young then, as the joke goes. Yeah. I don't remember. I was so young.
Oh, really?
Well, they said, when were you born? That's the old vaudeville. Because I don't remember. I was young.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
I mean, I know growing up what I read.
What'd you read?
I don't even know if most people know what their first comic was. I think that their memories just kind of confirmed what their favorite comic was, or the earliest.
What's the first one you remember reading?
Probably, well, there was Peanuts in the newspapers.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And also, whatever humor strips were running at the time in the Daily News, papers like that.
Yeah.
In the New York area. I mean, the New York area was great because, like other big cities, Chicago, LA, you had multiple newspapers, you had lots of syndicated TV channels, tons of magazine newsstand racks. So you got everything was available, pretty much.
Yeah.
Although things were still regional, and you did still have areas which were barren for certain companies. I never saw a Charlton comic on the racks that I know of.
Yeah.
Growing up, even though they were still in business, and I don't remember ever really seeing Atlas, although a friend of mine found them for the brief time that they were in business. I loved the newspaper comics. They were right in front of your face. One of the earliest things I remember that was comics was Tintin, because it was running in Children's Digest magazine. It was either Children's Digest or Humpty Dumpty, which I think were probably related kids' magazines. My mom had gotten me a subscription to that, so I remember that's where I first saw Tintin. And I was the memory I have of, you know, you have these weird, sharp, quick memories of when you were little. I just remember being in the foyer of my apartment building and holding the latest issue and waiting for the elevator. So I know that was pretty early in my life, if it was that apartment. And the first superhero comics I read, which was what I was a huge fan of, was Marvel.
Yeah.
And, you know, comics were just around. It's like my wife talks about her father's friends and him, that, you know, they had copies of Doctor Strange and Thor and things, and Silver Surfer. They were all hippies.
Yeah.
So comics, you'd go to the barber shop, and there'd be Superman, coverless Superman comics, things like that.
Yeah.
But I remember the first four comics I bought, those I do remember, with my own money, and they were a quarter a piece, and it was a Spider-Man issue. It would have been the era where Ross Andrew and Mike Esposito were working on the art, and Jerry Conway was probably writing. It was like Mysterio was on the cover holding up his head.
Uh-huh.
And Spider-Man, you know, it's funny how these things stay with you.
Yeah.
He's shooting a web through it. And the same month, Marvel Tales was out with a reprint of an old Romita Stan Lee Mysterio story from the 60s.
Yeah.
There was an FF issue that was Rich Buckler, inked by Joe Sinnott. I thought it was a Kirby cover. Go figure if it's Rich Buckler.
Uh-huh.
And then Marvel's Greatest Heroes, which had a Kirby Lee Sinnott reprint from the 60s. That was the nice thing about comics back then, is that I could buy anybody, you know, all my friends were into comics to some degree.
Yeah.
Casually or hardcore, like me, Mike Kemper, Clifford Black, with the three guys that really were into comics. You could just casually pick up what was going on in the current comics in 1970, 71, 72, and they were reprinting the stuff that it came from. So you could get the backstory on what happened before.
Sure.
And even though there was a full continuity and it was fairly complex to the average person, you know, my mom didn't want to know anything about it.
Yeah, no, I know.
You know, And they, my mom, if I ever started talking about it, started to get this glazed over look, like if somebody started to explain role-playing game. You know what I'm saying? Or you had to fill out your own tax forms or health insurance. And imagine if you had to explain it. I mean, I don't understand what's going on in comics now. I did a job for Marvel. I mean, this was a while ago. I wrote a story that Kevin Maguire did the art for, and it was a funeral for Captain America because he died again. And, you know, I think it was like the 13th time or something. And I wrote this funeral, and they sent back all these notes. And I wasn't upset. The notes wasn't what upset me. It was confusing to find out that Hawkeye was a villain on the run. This one's dead. That one's now a hero. This one, you know, all the classic characters as I knew them. And I still paid attention. I had no idea what was going on, apparently.
Yeah.
This one's been dead 5 times. This Rick Jones is now this, and it was really eye-opening how confusing it got, because you didn't just have to know who was, it was really like my sister's soap operas. You didn't just have to know who you're watching on the screen. You had to know the relationship they had to everybody else in the show and to 5 years back.
But you don't think it's always been that way? Because this is sort of the debate that I've had.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, I was just saying, like, this is sort of the debate that I've had with friends who grew up around the same time I do. And, you know, they've turned sort of like a lot of these TV shows into like soap operas. And they're like, well, oh, I hate all the mushy mushy. And I'm like, yeah, but like Peter Parker was like freaking out about Gwen Stacy and MJ, and Clark always had romantic troubles with Lois Lane. Like they were kind of thinly veiled operas, right?
There's no argument there. Like comics, especially under Stan Lee, the superhero comics always had the soap. I mean, if you can, there's the argument to be made that the Romita era, especially of his strength, was in doing romance comics.
Yeah.
Lee was really pressing that, especially since he wasn't working with Ditko anymore, who was not as interested in pushing that. Ditko wasn't going to draw multiple panels of Mary Jane and Gwen having a dance off at the
Hobby. Yeah.
And he wouldn't have pulled it off as beautifully as Romita either. I love both versions of the book. I think I like Ditko's more to some degree, because when Stan wasn't a career... Let's put it this way without getting it. When Kirby and Ditko were around, characters were flying out of their pens.
Yeah.
Romita was not... Guys like Romita, Buscema, not as much in the character creation from top to bottom. So you have in the first 30-some-odd issues of Spider-Man, a couple of dozen amazing characters visually and conceptually, concept-wise, that are still being made into action figures and used in movies these days. And then you start getting into things like Man Mountain Marco and and the Magia, who are, for me, really kind of dull.
Yeah.
Which is a far cry from Blizzard, Electro, Dr. Octopus, blah, blah, blah. And the same goes for Buscema. I mean, at that point, also Roy Thomas seemed to be much more interested in cementing continuity rather than doing pastiches of weird tales, events, and science fiction he read with these characters that he loved, and wanted to fix all the problems as he saw it with the continuity. So things got weirder in the 70s and late 60s. But the comics have always been, there's always the subplots and the soap opera have always been important to to Spider-Man, especially. It might be one of the reasons that the Fantastic Four doesn't translate well to so many people, because the core of the Fantastic Four is that they're kind of, as screwed up as they are, they're a pretty happy family unit amongst themselves.
Yeah.
Married couple, a popular boy, and your fucked up drunk uncle. Nevertheless, has a girlfriend. And even though everybody can't get him to remain happy, the four of them live together in this, you know, and they go and have adventures. So they've always had to fuck them up. They've had to make the Thing an even bigger dick. They've had to have Johnny keep breaking up with people for, like, almost, it was like wrestling. They had to just basically hammer, you know, you're no longer going out with Crystal. Why? We don't know what to do with this book.
Okay.
So everyone quits, even though there's really nothing to quit about.
Yeah.
It's not like Hawkeye. You know why Hawkeye quits. He was frustrated sexually.
Wait a minute. What?
Read the first in the old books. He couldn't get a date with it. He liked the Wasp. The Wasp was taken. He liked the Scarlet Witch. She didn't like him. The Black Widow dumps him.
I always thought that he was in love with Captain America. or that he couldn't live up to Captain. I'm joking. Well, that's a joke.
Up to Captain America, but that's I guess a new modern take.
No. I was just joking. That's just a joke. I may have to delete that.
Later on, when I dropped comics, he had just married Mockingbird, and I think they killed her off.
Yeah.
He was always pissed off.
I thought he was always felt inferior to Captain America. That's sort of like my.
Well, he should.
Yeah. As should everyone.
He needed therapy. I mean, if you pick archery as your thing,
yeah,
expect to be fourth rate. Even if you are the best archer on earth, you are still going to stand by. You know, Green Arrow gets with it. He's got money, so, and he's always got a girlfriend. But Hawkeye, you know, never got the fact that it's like comics. If you pick comics as your thing, you're always going to be behind filmmakers, novelists, and rock singers, resin kit builders,
players, holy cow,
bar pizza organ repairmen.
No.
One man bands.
Oh my god.
Organ grinders.
All right, so
special cupcake chefs.
Come on.
So he picked, you know what I mean? And then he decided to become a giant. He decided to get the giant man powers,
yeah.
Which is always a loser.
Oh my god.
He likes those characters because they're hard to write for, and they're hard for the artist to fit into the panels with the regular size characters.
Oh, that's a good point. I never thought about that. That's interesting. That's it. So at what point do you sort of decide that you want to get into comics, though, like, and make your own?
About 2 weeks ago.
Well, then you've obviously been traveling in the TARDIS.
I always wanted to be a Farfisa organ repairman.
Because
I knew that they get all the chicks.
Oh, wow.
No. Yeah.
There must have been a point where you thought, like, you were reading them and you're like, I want to make these things, but not necessarily, like, the superhero stuff, right?
No, I wanted to do the superhero stuff.
Oh, really? From the beginning?
Do you hear what I'm talking about the last 25
minutes?
Well,
no, I do, but you're...
This is what I grew up on.
Yeah, but your body of work, especially from the beginning, or at least what I'm aware of...
My body of work is out of shape. Let's not talk about it.
No. Your body of work is excellent, and, you know...
Thank you.
These two issues of the Eltingville Club are, like... that's something else that I wanted to get to later, but they're so the thing that blows me away about your panels and all that is they're so incredibly detailed. Like, you do not skimp on stuff.
That's why I have, yeah.
No, you don't.
I know I'm trying to be less self-deprecating, but yeah. I do very busy work. I grew up on, you know, the other comic, going back briefly to, if I could do anything briefly, the other comic that I was a big deal growing up was Mad.
Yeah.
I read Cracked, but that was because, you know, you wish Mad came out twice.
Yeah.
And, I like John Severin's stuff.
Yeah.
But Mad would often, I loved Mad, the magazine, and a lot of the artists in there, but Mad would often reprint the 50s comics in the super specials, the summer special and things like that. And so you'd get the Kurtzman era stuff. And I really went nuts for, and I still am, for Will Elder.
Uh-huh.
I love Bill Elder stuff. I liked Wally Wood stuff too, but in my mind, I conflated the two. I always, because he put a lot of detail in there, I always thought some of the Wally Wood stuff, it turns out that was Elder, but it turned out to be Wood.
Huh.
Which is pretty amazing that Wood could do solid adventure stuff, solid humor stuff, solid fantasy stuff. I mean, he's given a lot of props, but he can even be given more, I think.
Oh, he's a legend, in my opinion.
Sure. A very sad.
Yeah.
Example of somebody who clearly comics was a driving, you know, was an obsession.
Yeah.
For him, and it didn't, you know, comics is and was a rough business. I mean, lots of businesses are rough. It's not rough as far as sitting at the table, but the pay has always been, you know, almost like, you know, finding rainbows. It's like, you know,
yeah.
You will literally get, he, you know, he got screwed out of money. He got screwed out of things. Everyone got screwed out of recognition. Anyway, so yeah, Mann was a big deal, and Bill Elder was a maximalist, and Wally Wood was a maximalist, and Jack Kirby, who was my favorite, and you know, back then people put a lot of panels on the page, and there was a lot more going on.
Yeah.
And then George Perez came on the scene, and I didn't see his White Tiger stuff or his Sons of the Tiger, I think.
Yeah.
I didn't buy any of the Kung Fu comics as a kid, but when he got on Avengers and Fantastic Four and even Logan's Run of all things, I was buying them, and I was knocked out by his art, because he, if a crowd of people, like Kirby, if a crowd of people was supposed to be in a fight, he drew a crowd of people.
Yeah.
He didn't draw two guys and a bunch of arms sticking out of the sides of the panels. Yeah. He was into it.
Yeah.
And I always admired that about his work. And Byrne did the same thing. John Byrne was somebody I was really into.
Yeah, me too.
Cockrum, that insane issue. I didn't know his Legion of Superheroes stuff, because I was not a DC fan as a kid. And so when he did that, there's that issue of, the new X-Men, him and Claremont, where although the... help me jog my memory. The Gladiator and all those folks.
Oh, the Imperium, like the Shi'ar?
Shi'ar, right.
Yeah.
There's an issue where it's basically just a slugfest.
Yeah.
But it's not a slugfest the way that they do it now, where it's two panels, three panels, and a lot of blowing up, and the colorist comes in and just makes light shows.
Yeah.
I mean, it was the X-Men versus the Imperial Guard, and they just... It was just awesome for, I enjoyed, that was a big deal. I haven't thought about that in a while, but they just clobbered the hell out of each other. And I didn't realize until a few months after, on a reread, that a lot of those characters were analogs for Legion characters.
Yeah.
So that's a really nice, you know what I mean? Fans came in and started doing some really cool things like that, but you didn't have to understand that they were Legion analogs to get to enjoy the issue. You didn't have to understand that the, Mark Gruenwald's Squadron Supreme was an analog of the JLA to kind of, because they would give you that, going back to what you were saying before, they would give you that information.
Yeah.
The comics were written in a different way. More panels, a lot of exposition in captions.
Yeah.
And the characters were also much more, everything was much more reductive. Spider-Man was Peter Parker. He's a photographer. He's got a black cloud over his head. He feels guilty and responsible because of his Uncle Ben. He fights criminals. He has a crazy boss. He likes girls. He doesn't seem to realize he's good looking and they like him.
Yeah.
Okay, boom. Now try talking about what Spider-Man now has been divorced because of the devil.
And, yeah.
And he's had extra girlfriends, and there's been clones, and there's been clones of his girlfriends, and there's been multiple Spider-Mans, and then he wore an alien suit for a whole, and that stuff wouldn't be so important if it wasn't still ongoing in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Between the video games and the action figures and the actual... Secret Wars is a complete callback to whatever, Secret Wars was back in the day. And Crisis on Infinite Earths is still name-checked, even though it was supposed to not have happened.
Yeah.
So these things, eventually you pile up enough dishes, they collapse. And yeah. I can't understand this stuff, and it is genetically built into me to understand this stuff.
Yeah.
Now if I try to figure, if somebody tells me, oh yeah, the Scorpion is this, and there's these other guys, and now there's like the seventh person in the Beetle costume or whatever, I'm like, okay, my head hurts. You know what I mean? I gotta go lie down.
So, but what is your art like? I mean, because there's a lot of people that say that those characters just can't stay like preserved in amber, like Peter.
But they
Parker.
Are still preserved in amber in a lot of ways. That's what's bizarre. That's true. It's just new trappings.
Yeah.
It's just more confusion. The fact is, Batman is still Batman.
Yeah.
I mean, he's really still Batman. And every time he loses a Robin, he gets a new Robin.
Yeah.
And every time and Commissioner Gordon still can't fucking figure out that his best friend, who hangs around with a kid, shows up in his office, they talk for 5 minutes, they go out the door, they come back in, and there's Batman with a kid. And he can't, he's the best cop, he's the commissioner of police, and he can't just go, Bruce, cut the shit. Yeah. First of all, stop running around with that kid. Do you know how much trouble you're going to get in? And yeah. I can book you right now on cruelty to children and for putting a minor in harm's way.
Well, but that's sort of the thing, right? Like, that's us as adults, like, looking at that stuff, right? But when you and I were kids or teenagers, like, we thought that was cool, right? Like, we were
No. Spider-Man's cool. Batman sucked.
No, but I'm saying, like...
I'm kidding. But
No, you know what I mean. Like,
of course I know what you mean. But the thing is, now we've tried to make... writers and artists are so uptight... You remember that you ever go to conventions back in like the 90s and before things it became cool to go to a convention, there'd be a couple of guys in there that were overly muscular and they dragged their girlfriends on ice to the place. All the writers and artists are like that to a degree now. They're embarrassed that there was zebra Batman. Try to make it work through some kind of drug hallucination nonsense that Grant Morrison runs it through the mill. They try to ignore that there was ever Zebra Batman, that there was ever Batmite, that there was a, you know, they always have to bring drugs up when Batmite's brought back or something.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Captain Marvel talks to a tiger in a suit.
Yeah.
Make that tiger eat people's heads. You could be Jeff Loeb, just start having animals from cartoons eating superheroes or whatever. Doesn't change it.
Yeah.
Still Batman, still Batmite, still Bathound. You just don't worry about it.
Yeah. Well, we keep getting away from you.
And
we
That's
keep
talking. I'm talking to you.
But I mean, when did you start drawing comics? Because that's two weeks ago. 2 weeks ago. You already answered that question.
When this interview started.
It's
opened up my pineal gland and now I've begun to live.
So basically what you're telling me is that you have a TARDIS and you went back to the late 80s, early 90s and started creating comics about 5 minutes ago.
No, I don't.
All right.
TARDIS. Come on.
Oh, wait. So you're a big fan. You don't like Doctor Who?
No, I like Dr. Key fine. He's all right. Whoever he is now. But I mean, I hated it when I was a kid because the effects were so bad. And then I learned to be less of a dick. And the Tom Baker stuff cracks me up. And Doctor Who's fine, but I don't have time. I don't know how people have time to binge weekly on 20 series. I mean, I have friends who, you know, they've watched. You know, I'm caught up on Gotham. I'm caught up on Orange is the New Black. I'm caught up on Doctor Who and The Flash and Green Arrow. Who the fuck has all that time?
Well, I don't. You must be watching something, right? Or enjoying something, right? Is there any show or?
No, I'm not following. This is not me being condescending. We got rid of cable. A little before my daughter was born, because we realized we weren't using it and there was no reason to spend all that money on a clock.
Yeah.
We just never got back in the habit. I've got Netflix.
Yeah.
And we've watched a bunch of shows with my daughter.
Yeah.
But we haven't watched the last TV show I watched was reruns of Kolchak, The Night Stalker with my daughter.
Yeah.
And, you know, Kolchak's a crappy show, but it's a great character and it's a lot of fun.
Sure.
I loved it as a kid. It's I've been watching it mostly like with my editorial hat on going, you know, here, how the show kind of fell apart, how the premise just didn't hang together for 20 episodes and blah, blah, blah. But I mean, the character's great. And sometimes there's a really cool episode, especially early on, but I'm not watching anything that's been made in the last like 10, 15 years. I figure I always tell people I'll be in an old folks home if I can afford it one day. And, you know, this stuff will all be in the ether or on the net. I'll be able to catch up on The Wire, you know.
Gotcha.
I'll be able to watch whatever that Evil Dead thing is they're doing.
The Walking Dead.
But no. Aren't they doing an Ash show?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Ash versus Evil Dead or something. Yeah.
I watched like several years of Xena with my daughter. She really likes that. And I mean, I liked it. It was a lot of fun, you know. But everything I was watching before my daughter was born, I burnt out on. I got sick of Buffy after about season and a half. Uh-huh. Started to really dislike it. I got sick of the X-Files. Got on my nerves. It doesn't mean that it's a bad show. It just means it just didn't work for me. And there were individual episodes I liked a lot. But I couldn't get into anything.
So
and,
you haven't seen the Livewire episode of Supergirl, the character that you co-created?
We didn't co-create her at all.
Didn't you? I thought you did. I thought you wrote that episode.
No, I feel bad because people have been writing, tweeting me about this and that, and they're like, We shaped the personality of the character for the animated series.
Yeah.
Because that first episode. And, we did backstory stuff and, you know, all that writerly crap you're supposed to do.
But it was
on costume. And we didn't come up with the name or the character. That's Warner Brothers. That's Bruce, Tim, maybe Paul Dini worked on that one. I don't know exactly who worked on her. But I didn't see the episode, so I have no idea if they went with anything based on what we did. And I wasn't happy with our first episode anyway. So that was the first thing we ever wrote for television that wasn't Space Ghost, I think. Uh-huh. And Space Ghost isn't the kind of show where you're writing fully realized, developed plots or characters. So Livewire was the first thing, and I think we did a stiff job on it. You know, we just weren't quite. Sarah and I really weren't feeling our way. We were feeling our way around, so it was a little weird. Plus, the episode changed a lot from conception to when we started writing it.
Uh-huh.
We had done an outline for it, real quickly. This is fan stuff. I mean, but I think people find it interesting. I mean, Livewire's episode was supposed to have taken place. It ended up, I think, running as the last episode or next to last of the first season. I can't remember now. But she was supposed to be this shock jock. Who I guess in a way also had a little bit of Ann Coulter to her. Uh-huh. She was really, really stirring up this anti-immigration fervor for Superman. She was afraid of him, and she knew that, you know, screaming about him being this alien and that we knew nothing about him and that he had these powers. And we really played up the paranoia of what if he was somebody who was prepping the human race to get used to him, and then, you know, 40 or 1,000 of them show up.
Yeah.
He had, you know, she was saying he has us in the palm of his hand. And because at the time that they were working on this episode, they had not made the decision to have the character go public.
Okay.
In the show. So in the series, he was going to spend more time in the shadows, not like Batman, but just basically he didn't stay around. He would not stick around to talk to reporters.
Oh, gotcha.
So that's why he was still sort of like a mystery, and nobody knew what his motivations were. So she was getting people worked up, and he was basically going to have to do a press conference during this thing, and that's where she was going to get zapped and turn into the Livewire character, and people were going to be blaming him for that. A few things changed. One, they started they found that this was kind of chaining the character down in a few scripts. So they wanted the character to be more public. So that angle left. And then the whole idea that the electricity that amps through Superman and goes into her, DC got rabid about anything that took away from the Superman character. Going back to Eltingville 2, this was an example of fandom when it becomes just silly.
Yeah.
Professional fandom.
Yeah.
Because the only people who really become professionals in this industry are fans.
Okay.
You really want to do this.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true of a lot of other things, but, you know, a lot of people come into the industry because they want to fix things.
Yeah.
They want their whack at Spider-Man or Batman or Superman or whatever, or they think this run was terrible and they have better ideas. But they come in with an agenda, there were certain people who will go unnamed at DC Comics who really, they didn't want Supergirl to be from Krypton because that would somehow take away from Superman's uniqueness.
Yeah.
Even though the Phantom Zone criminals are all from Krypton.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you wouldn't believe what kind of trouble this can cause a production. A lot of time was spent coming up with a new, reworking her origin. I think it came out well. I'm really happy with the work everybody did, including, you know, Sarah and I did with Paul and Alan and Bruce and everybody on the Supergirl episodes. Then the second episode got completely screwed up, but that's another story. But yeah, you would constantly have people go, no, you can't do that. Paul Levitz wouldn't let them use the Joker on an episode of Powerpuff Girls.
Oh, just really?
Weird, arbitrary, not on my watch strangeness. The idea that I'm getting after doing Sarah and I have done some work for Warner Brothers in the last few years, which I wish we could talk about, but it's all shelved show Bibles and pitch Bibles and things can't talk about. One of them did involve a DC character, and it really seems like the tail is not wagging the dog as far as DC Comics really doesn't have a hell of a lot to say about DC animation or DC production. I mean, I'm sure Jeff Johns, I don't know what the role is there, but I'm sure he's like, we can do this, we can do that. But I don't think anybody at DC Comics, even though they created them, can stop them from using the Joker in a Powerpuff joke.
Yeah.
It's pointless. DC would not let me use DC characters in the backgrounds of the Welcome to Eltingville pilot.
Oh, really?
And, And DC, even though the Cartoon Network is owned by Warner Brothers, who owns DC Comics, and the Adult Swim and all that is one company generally, DC could say no.
Yeah.
Which seems dumb.
Yeah.
Because it's just, you know, but these are companies that will get on your case if they think you're making fun of their characters. You know, they, sure. Sometimes they would have real problems with that. Now they just want everything to be everywhere, which from a corporate view makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Well, didn't you do some writing on the Superman Adventures comic as well?
Yeah. Yeah. That was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
we didn't have to, you know, we knew it didn't matter because it wasn't the show and it wasn't canon.
Yeah. But it was great.
I'm very happy with the first two stories we did with Supergirl. The Livewire stories didn't work out as well. We overwrote, and the art really, you know, not to piss on another person, but the art was not really to my liking. There were problems with that. There was actually a general editorial goof up. The wrong script was used at one point.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, an unedited version of something. So these things happen. The book was on its way out, so, you know. But some people liked it. I'm not going to go tell them not to like it.
Well, I liked it.
I don't think it was some of our best writing, so these things happen. I mean, it starts with us on that one, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, at what point did you, and I know we're coming up on an hour, I don't want to keep you too.
I knew I wanted to draw comics. I interrupt and I get off tangents, but I tend to remember what you asked me. I wanted to draw comics at a fairly early age, but I didn't think I wanted to write comics. I don't even think I thought hard about what that would be like. But as a kid, I would draw my own comics just like a lot of other kids. And, lunchtime, I'd spend lunch with my friend Michael Krugman. And, you know, we were going to make a Captain America comic. And it's cute when kids – and we were like 13, I guess, when you're young and you've got this project you're going to do as if it matters, like as if it's going to be a real thing. Like, we're going to do Captain America's on a space – mission, and there's a lizard. It's stupid. Why is Captain America on a space mission, you know?
Yeah.
And you go into it with that fervor. I mean, if you can keep that kind of fun attitude, you can really make enjoyable goofball comics of any kind.
Sure.
That's the whole thing, is try not to lose that, you know, gee whiz, holy shit, anything you want you can put on paper idea when you're doing the Biff Bam Pow stuff or your own stuff. But when you're doing the crazy stuff, you really, if you're not having fun, again, it's just like reading them. If you're not having fun, if it's a chore, you got to really check your head and see, why isn't this working?
Yeah.
And if it's, sometimes it's editorial and interference, because that happens more often than it happened when I was first starting out, at least. Editorial hired who they trusted and then edited, rather than what happens a lot from what we're seeing, is that editorial tells you, this is what we want, and this is the plan for so-and-so for the next 6 months, and then it has to tie into this thing, and then it has to tie into that thing, and then you have to cross over with that thing. That just seems crazy.
Well,
but yeah, I knew I wanted to do comics, I guess, when I was 13-14. I started to really, really think maybe I could do this, and my idea was that I would become a Marvel penciler that did backups.
Gotcha.
Because being a fearful person most of my life, and to this day, lesser than I used to be, I just would, I aimed low.
Uh-huh.
I thought I'd have my own book. I never thought I'd be doing Justice League. I started getting to DC when I was like 16, because a lot of Marvel guys went over. I dropped out of comics when I got heavy into animation. Uh-huh. And friends in high school got me back into comics, the bastards. And Perez was on New Teen Titans, so I started picking that up because I loved his stuff over at Marvel. But anyway, I just thought, you know, maybe I could get it by 30, which is ridiculous. By 30, maybe I'll get some backup stories and I'll pencil them. They don't have backup stories much these days, or file stories where they throw things together in case the deadlines are shot. Now they'll just hold the book up forever.
Yeah.
At some point, I started realizing that I was writing my own comics because I needed something to draw.
Yeah.
You can't draw comics without writing comics.
Yeah.
Without somebody writing them. And I think that at some point I realized I was really a writer who drew, not an artist who wrote.
Huh.
But way I came across it. I think I'm a much better writer than I am artist. But I draw well enough to get done what my comics call for.
You are,
that makes sense.
Yeah, you're killing me though, because I hate.
I'm a decent gag cartoonist, and I can draw funny. And certainly when you're drawing something like Milk and Cheese, it's the kind of comic that really comes out of one person generally. It's just a goof comic. And the gag strips and, you know, stuff like Eltingville, just it, you know, each has a slightly different approach to the art, but it's not the same art that you would be doing Spider-Man or the FF, which is what I wanted to do growing up. At some point, things like Love and Rockets and Neat Stuff came out, and these one-man or two-man comics that were done that involved genre, but also humor and also autobiographical elements from the cartoonist's lives. Their interests were in there. They didn't have any corporate mandate. They just did what they wanted to do.
Sure.
A lot of free weeklies in New York were publishing things. The New York Press and the Village Voice were publishing Pfeiffer and Matt Groening's Life in Hell. And you had Charles Burns, and you had Stephen by Doug Allen, and you had Linda Barry. So you had Mark Bayer was in there doing Amy and Jordan. So I was working in a comic store by the age of 18. So Jim Hanley, who was the co-owner of the comic store, was handing us all these different things. So Eisner's Spirit, old comic strips, foreign stuff, Raw was coming out. So at the same, so I'm reading Crisis on Infinite Earth, and I'm also reading Jimbo by Gary Panter.
Yeah.
And it was just a great influx of good, bad, and great, bad, and good, great crap.
Yeah.
Whatever. And a lot of that stuck with me. And then I, you know, there was the Ninja Turtles had come out, and a lot of people were publishing, self-publishing, and putting together comics companies. Most of them were fly-by-nights. Most of them were not there to put out great comics, but to make as much money as possible, as quickly as possible, while store owners were buying 20 of everything.
Yeah.
Hoping to get the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles number one on their wall, and which is where I got to see, you know, tulip craze nonsense, you know, pyramid scheme publishing tactics, and became really, where I do not like to do variant covers or gimmicks and things like that, or instant collectibles or forced collectibles, because I was in the comic industry in a time where I watched it collapse constantly.
Yeah.
The post Turtles thing blew up a lot of stores, destroyed some distributors. The comics in bags. It was just anything that people were buying for, like, you know, how many Man of Steel's number ones were out there, and then you had the next thing. And I mean, but even in the 70s, I knew that Howard the Duck and Captain Marvel, Shazam number one, there were boxes of them floating around.
Yeah.
This early speculation on early non-return retailing was starting to happen. You're stuck with those books that you buy, you know?
Yeah.
And if you buy too many Godzilla variants or whatever, that one doesn't hit, you're stuck with them.
Yeah. Okay, so that was part one of my interview with Evan Dorkin. As you can tell, he liked to chat a lot. He was very verbose. So I've split this interview into two parts. Part two will air early next week, before Christmas, and we will have a chat about Star Wars the week after that. And the reason I did not want to delve right into Star Wars is because I had, you know, part two with Evan Dorkin, and I thought that was a really great interview to do, and it's a really interesting listen, at least in my opinion. And, you know, I didn't want to sort of jump into the Star Wars critique right away. I know we tend to do that sometimes on Part-Time Fanboy, but I figured I'd let it simmer for a week. You know, it's Christmas and things are busy. And I also have a guest coming on who is really well-versed in Star Wars. So I wanted to give him time to enjoy his holiday and deal with whatever he had to deal with so that he could come on and enjoy his time on Part-Time Fanboy. So next week will be part two of Evan Dorkin. And then the week after that, I will finally be talking about Star Wars, The Force Awakens. So as always, thank you for listening to this episode. And I hope you all have a wonderful holiday season. And we will be back next week with part two of Evan Dorkin. Thanks for listening. Bye.
part-time fanboy.